Nick Reich here with Zachary Fillingham of geopoliticalmonitor.com on this December 6th, 2018. And Zach, you started writing on the site about both the idea of a European Union army, which is being floated, but also the increasing prevalence of countries attempting to manufacture and sell arms in order to increase domestic revenues. So I was wondering if you could start by talking a little bit about the history of Europe and the European Union militarily, and how we've gotten to where we are today with NATO and primarily nation-based militaries.
Okay, well, the idea of collective European defense under the auspices of Europe itself has been around a long time, but it has always crashed up against the rocks of essentially the fact that NATO is the primary provider of defense for Europe through the Cold War period. And that idea has been perpetuated, you know, throughout the years, mostly by the United Kingdom's presence within the European Union. The UK has always blocked attempts to sort of move in that direction. So we'll talk about this a bit later, but two of the major consequences of Brexit, one of them is positive in terms of European defense, insofar that you remove that historical roadblock to the development of European institutions of shared collective defense, specifically from an industrial point of view. But unfortunately, the drawback, also from an industrial point of view, is you take away one of the major contributors to the EU budget, and a country that has some of the biggest defense companies in the world, specifically BAE. So it'll be interesting going forward on that front. But I would say that, you know, there's a little bit of shifting geopolitical sands in terms of NATO and in terms of the European Union's threat perceptions toward their neighborhood.
So what are the biggest threats that the EU would be seeking to protect itself from, if not one another?
I would say that the big game changer here is obviously the Ukraine crisis in 2014, and it's obviously still playing out in a very destabilizing way in the Kerch Strait crisis most recently. I think that the biggest impact that the Ukraine crisis has had is that it brought back the possibility of annexation by force, territorial annexation. As a student, as anyone who you know, has any academic background from the 2000s knows, there was this prevailing belief in Europe that history was kind of over, that these sort of things were not going to happen again in the future post-Cold War, and that we had entered into a sort of global liberal institutional order that would self-police and sort of put an end to war by territorial acquisition. The Ukraine crisis comes along and proves that that's not the case. So that in itself is not enough to motivate huge changes within the EU defense complex. However, it's also coinciding with the Trump presidency in the United States. And as we all know, anyone who's listened to a Trump speech knows, the U.S. president isn't a huge fan of NATO. And in his calling into question the ongoing U.S. commitment to NATO, he's precipitating a response within EU capitals, a movement towards, he's creating political will, real political will, for the Europeans to start taking limited charge of their own defense.
Limited. So who's calling for an EU army?
You've always had certain centers of power within Europe who wanted more of a, you know, wanted more of a responsibility, wanted the EU to take responsibility for its own defense. Generally speaking, this was usually the continental powers, France, Germany, and again, as I touched down, less so the UK. But now I think that you have sort of geopolitical events that you can point to, these leaders can point to and go to their populations and say, look, we need to start spending more on defense. The EU needs to start getting serious about collective self-defense, or even at a minimum, the consolidation of the European defense industry to reduce all these redundancies. For example, if you look at the EU stats, these statistics are much bandied about, and they're included in the articles on the website. Lack of cooperation between member states. So this is the current situation, and this is from an industrial point of view. So a lack of cooperation between member states costs anywhere between 25 to 100 billion euros every year. 80% of procurement and 90% of R&D are conducted on a strictly national basis. This is the one that really stands out. The EU is home to over 178 types of different weapon systems, compared to the United States that just has 30. And most of all, there are 17 different types of battle tanks in the European Union, and the US Army only has one, the M1 Abrams. So when you have all of these different systems, just take off the table the fact that getting them to actually work together in an operational sense is a nightmare. But you also have all these small economies of scale, all of these small defense contractors building the platforms. And since you have you don't benefit from any economy of scale, you don't benefit from any pooling of resources of the actual member governments of the EU. So this specifically is what the EU is looking to address now.
Now, some collaboration in terms of procurement, in terms of having systems work with one another, et cetera, sounds like it makes sense given the current political situation in Europe where there's countries getting along and there's the European Union. But presumably, additional collaboration would require giving up autonomy. So how willing do you think countries will be to give up their military autonomy to the EU? And will this be a major roadblock in going from collaboration to reduce expenses, increase efficiencies in, you know, minor ways to something more like a European military force that's more fully integrated?
Well, I think that Brussels is well aware that it has a problem on its hands right now. It's well aware, generally speaking, the leadership's aware that there is a huge populist anti-EU wave cresting on the continent right now, and that, you know, more Europe, quote unquote, is not what the doctor ordered. So given that realization, all of the mechanisms that are now being designed and launched, they're all designed with a very light-handed touch, a light touch. They're not imposing on governments. They're all voluntary, and they're all incentivized, most importantly. And the financial incentives, critically, are coming from the EU civilian budget. So basically, you have a situation whereby the EU is trying to put out all these sweeteners for member governments to come together. And even if it was just a question of coming together and coordinating, for example, procurement, right? You have one specific example right now, and a lot of these examples are specifically outlined within the articles and can't get into all of them. But for example, Germany and Norway have just on a bilateral basis come together to cooperate on the procurement of new submarines. And so these are 212 CD class diesel submarines. They're going to be built by ThyssenKrupp Marine Systems. And so they save on the per unit basis, right? This is common throughout global defense industry. You see it in the Joint Strike Fighter in NATO. You try to get more and more, the more countries that sign on to buy, the less per unit cost, right? So you have that direct cost savings right there. But also you have Germany and Norway designing a plan whereby they cooperate on all aspects of the subs. They cooperate on co-training, exercises, spare parts, and ongoing maintenance design, ongoing maintenance contracts. And then you also even have, as an end result, you save at every step of the way. So this is national budget saving, national defense budget saving. And you also have the fact that from an interoperability basis, in the future, you know, none of this is codified, none of this is legal, like there aren't laws forcing them to do this, but in the future, should they have to operate side by side, their crews are essentially operating in the same boats under the same standards with the same training. So you have those ad hoc bilateral initiatives, and those, obviously they're voluntary, right? Like the two governments come together, they think it's beneficial for both of them, which it is. And then you also have these EU initiatives like the European Defense Fund, which throws basically has a basic set of standards, which is like, for example, one aspect is there has to be three or more governments cooperating on something, right? So they say three governments or three national companies come together for some aspect, either research, development. As long as you have those three, they'll start throwing money. They'll start supplementing the funding of either research or development. And that money is coming from the EU civilian budget, right? So it's a pretty clear incentive. Oh, and also critically, the end technological result of these projects remains, you know, under the exclusive domain of the company or the country in question, right? So they're not giving up anything. They're not ceding anything to the EU. And so under these sort of conditions, why wouldn't you? It's just like the money's there. By foregoing it, you're doing nothing but foregoing the money. You're not like, no, there are no hard asks being made of the individual member states.
Now, a critique of President Trump regarding the EU and its military spending is that they've been unwilling to spend enough to pull their weight in NATO. If that's the case and there's a reluctance to increase military spending for the benefit of NATO, why would there be an interest in expanding military capacity domestically and in collaboration with other EU members as part of a loose or more defined EU military force?
Well, there's a couple of interesting aspects of the question you just asked. One of them is, like, so basically, Trump is trying to get the EU EU armies to spend more, the EU governments to spend more on their armed forces, which is, I mean, it makes sense, right? From President Trump's perspective, it makes sense, right? Like that there's a overwhelming burden on the United States in terms of providing NATO defense, right? So that makes sense. However, it might be a little bit of a careful what you wish for, because when you sort of precipitate this new spending, it might sort of develop in directions that the U.S. president didn't originally intend. Like, because, for example, so you start all this spending, you start all these programs for industrial consolidation within the European Union, right? The end result is that you essentially, you're creating your own competitor in the international arms market, right? So like you're going to have these more agile, larger European defense arms companies. And they're going to be competing with, you know, Raytheon, Lockheed Martin, the U.S. companies, right? Second of all, the Trump call for greater defense spending is accompanied by basically threats that undermine the long-term credibility of NATO. Like when he questions the possibility that NATO would come to the defense of Lithuania, who is a small, you know, a small Baltic state, but still a member of NATO, right? You're basically, you're calling into question the viability of NATO, and you're creating more political will in Europe to take control of its own defense, right? Because if you're defending yourself, like, you don't need to worry about the possibility, you know, that the United States will or won't come. This is a very old question for NATO, right?
And it's in the context of the United States increasingly unable and unwilling to pay such expenses, could this then be something that's positive for both sides? The United States can reduce their financial burden and providing military defense to Europe, and Europe can likewise increase their spending and increase their military capacity and form both the local capacity to defend themselves, but also to develop military companies that would offset that cost.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you could probably find, you know, people on both sides of the ocean that would say that that's the ideal situation.
And the weapons developed, where will they likely go?
You mean in the European Union for EU armed companies? Okay, so, I mean, when you're looking at the EU arms industry, you're comparing it to Russia, United States, increasingly China. It's at a severe disadvantage because, in the United States, specifically, and let's talk about the United States, huge amounts of money are poured into the military industrial complex. And those economies of scale, like the amount of the U.S. national budget for defense is massive, right? We all know that. But all of that money buying all of those arms creates like a huge industrial capacity for those companies, which they can in turn use to create an advantage for themselves in overseas markets, right? So if the EU were to actually successfully consolidate its defense industry, it would be selling arms to itself, right? In much a similar way. Whereas you sell arms to yourself, you have a large internal market, and then the economies of scale created by that internal market helps you in external markets, right? For example, okay, just one little example. The European Defense Fund, which is one of these incentivized voluntary mechanisms that the EU is promoting for their industrial overhaul. So over the last, since 2010, on average, it has produced, it has invested about 200 million euros into defense-related technology research in Europe, right? $200 million every year. In 2017, the United States, according to their defense budget, spent $51 billion on defense-related R&D.
So yeah, the European figure, that doesn't include the individual nations' research and development spending, I presume.
No, it doesn't. But it would still be dwarfed by, like, in absolute terms. I mean, obviously, in absolute terms, it would still be dwarfed because you have, like, in absolute terms, their military budgets are dwarfed by the United States, as countries around the world are, right? But the thing is, Even if you were to take all of those research budgets, put them together, okay? Let's say it comes up to half. So it's less of a startling statistic. Like, let's say you take all of them together, it comes to $25 billion, right? That $25 billion is spread across a Byzantine, like, disparate, fractured network of projects and technology. Like, it's not being coordinated at all. It's going into small initiatives all across the continent that may or may not bear fruit, but there's no focus and there's no pooling of the R&D budget that could potentially occur in the United States. Whereas, like, just for example, like the United States, there is a very promising technology, right? For example, you could devote a disproportionately high amount of your R&D budget towards that technology because it's so promising. Maybe in a defense aspect, in a marketing aspect, the fact that you could sell this technology on in the global arms trade. You don't have that kind of coordination in the European Union right now. And if you were to conceptualize all of these initiatives that are currently going on, broadly speaking, it's to create that kind of coordinating capacity within Europe so that they can take all of those budgets and make them the sum of their parts.
And Zach, do you have any sense of what the percentage dollar amounts would be? So obviously it's very expensive to develop, manufacture, and purchase weapon systems. But as discussed, there'd be some recouping of the cost and even some revenues from sales to other countries. Are we looking at simply reducing a percentage of the military budget, and if so, how much? Or what's the breakdown between the cost of military spending versus what can be generated or reduced from domestic production and sale?
Well, I mean, obviously, the companies themselves are the big winners. the companies, the shareholders, the ownership, like, those are the people that win in the most direct way when these budgets get inflated, these projects become massive. There's obviously, as well, a more diffuse economic benefit for, like, we're talking in general terms, right? Like, a national defense complex, an industrial, the national defense industry, you mean?
Correct.
Okay. So yeah, there's obviously a more diffuse economic benefit as well. We have the actual stats in the first article that went up, I think, last week or maybe 2 weeks ago, just the general backgrounder. There are the statistics with regards to the United States, how many jobs are created. I think it was something around, I mean, the actual statistic evades me right now. There are a lot of jobs directly created. There are a lot of jobs indirect. There are even more jobs indirectly created. And in the case of the United States, again, there's been so much consolidation in the defense industry that a lot of these factories are kind of self-sufficient economic ecosystems unto themselves, where if you were to remove it, it would be a serious political problem and a serious economic problem for all the people who live and work there. The same is true of Europe. There are, I think these specific stats are in the article itself, but there's some, you know, millions of indirect jobs, etc. But when you start selling the arms overseas, it creates an obvious benefit for all of these systems that have these systems, factories, and companies that have already been set up within your own country, right? But if you were to, and this is definitely beyond the scope of the articles that we're posting right now, but the real question on this is, obviously a lot of government money goes into this, right? A lot of government money goes into the defense budget. A lot of government money goes into subsidization. For example, a lot of government money goes into the United States helping its allies buy the arms that it itself produces, right? This is all taxpayer money. So the ultimate question, if you want to ask how efficient it all is, you need to start comparing it to other possible ways to spend that money. And how many jobs...
There's also the point that it's a non-productive industry. Like, the other than technological spin-offs, which, you know, can be significant, like the internet, microwaves, etc. It produces no value to society or the world. Either the weapons aren't used, which is ideal, they serve a defensive role, or they are used and create destruction and suffering. So in one sense, it's a non-productive industry that in an ideal world wouldn't be required. But of course, we don't live in an ideal world.
Yeah, exactly. And that's also another sort of subjective conversation for another day. I agree. I mean, preferably they would not be used at all. When I started, you know, conceptualizing this article series, one of the things that sort of interested me initially is that the defense industry is non-tradable. You know, it's obviously it's manufacturing intensive, and it won't move overseas, right? So in an age where a lot of the North American manufacturing base has been offshored, I think it's particularly appealing in that it creates all of this conventional benefits of a manufacturing industry. But given the sensitivity in terms of national security, generally speaking, it won't be offshore. Now, sometimes it is, but generally speaking, it won't be offshore. So you have this interesting little comparison to be made. If you're looking at a country like China, like the Chinese system of state capitalism, where obviously they can still exert a large level of state control over the composition of their economy, and they can sort of maintain these lumbering industrial giants, these state-owned enterprises creating cement or steel or whatever, not so much because they're productive, but because of the employment and sort of run-on societal benefits that they produce, right? Are Western countries turning to defense production, the defense industry, in sort of a similar way, where, you know, it's the one thing you can control, it's the one thing you can dump money into, and you know that there's going to be a sort of economic benefit at home? I don't know.
So what do you see happening in terms of NATO? Is this idea of increased EU integration going to reduce the role and importance of NATO?
Yeah.
Has the suggestion of the United States, in fact, triggered an EU response that will expedite the decline of NATO?
I think that all of this needs to be qualified seriously with the fact that it's not the first time an EU army has been talked about. It's not the first time the US commitment to NATO has been questioned. All of this has happened before, and it will likely happen again. So I personally am a little bit skeptical about talk of NATO being replaced by some sort of in-house European collective defense mechanism. What I think is more interesting here is the industrial stuff. And most of the articles are focused on the industrial stuff, because the industrial stuff is like the industrial consolidation, the harmonization of procurement, training, etc. That's the low-hanging fruit here. And it's basically the low-hanging fruit because everybody can agree on how beneficial it is just from a strictly national, like even just to get more out of your national defense budget, everyone can agree that this is beneficial. So I think there's a very good possibility that these initiatives will go on, sort of the ad hoc bilateral cooperation, the European Defense Fund, PESCO, again, all of it is described more in depth within the articles. I think that when it comes to actual interoperability and developing a collective defense mechanism within Europe, I'm more skeptical. I don't know what the next U.S. president's attitude toward NATO will be, but I'll tell you one thing, too. We haven't really touched down on this yet. I think we might not have time. I don't know. But the exit of the United Kingdom from the European Union also throws a huge wrench into these plans, because the UK is one of the top three contributors to the EU budget. It has 13% of the total EU budget, military spending, or sorry, it accounts for 13%. It accounts for 13% of the EU budget, and it has the highest military budget of any EU state. So when you remove the UK from the EU, I mean, like, the capacity that's left over is a lot less credible, especially because the capacity that's left over in Italy, France, and Germany, it's lacked the political will to seriously spend on those three countries' military for a long time. And also, just one last thing on this, the early indications of post-Brexit, I mean, who knows what happens with Brexit, right? That's still happening. That's still deeply uncertain. No one knows how that's going to pan out. But the early indications of post-Brexit, the possibility of post-Brexit EU-UK cooperation, are not positive. Specifically, the fact that the UK has pulled out of Galileo, which was a massive civilian defense project. Basically, exactly what you would kind of want in the defense realm. Galileo could serve as a positive example of pooling investment, pooling research resources. So it was launched in 2003. Spent $11 billion has been spent on it. It's the alternative to the U.S. developed global positioning system, and it's going to be a European satellite tracking network, right? And because the UK is leaving the EU, it can no longer, by EU regulations, it can no longer have access to the military aspects of the program. So the UK wouldn't be able to design weapon systems that tap into Galileo anymore after it leaves the EU. And another bad sign is that, and this is, again, this is in the article, we didn't get to it, but there is a Franco-German initiative to develop a sixth generation fighter jet, which was announced last year, and they're trying to build a sort of consortium of companies to go forward with this. And generally speaking, BAE would be the UK's BAE would be a good partner, like a almost one might even say necessary partner for this kind of initiative if you were trying to replace the Eurofighter consortium. But the BAE is forwarding its own competing consortium to develop a sixth generation fighter. So basically, early indications are bad that the UK and the EU will cooperate in the defense realm if the UK spins totally out of the EU.
Interesting. And Zach, in your article talking about the arms trade more broadly, what countries and what are the news and developments in terms of other countries looking at defense as an industry that they want to get into on an international scale?
Well, the initial idea behind this series was to track sort of developments in the global arms industry, specifically looking at new potential players, because the economic incentive, I mean, it doesn't just exist for the United States and the EU. It theoretically exists for South Korea, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, any country that wants to create, a self-sufficient capacity to build arms and a domestic internal market for defense companies. So basically, other countries are catching on, and these three, like this was split into three articles because the EU is a very complicated subject, but going forward, we're going to look at other potential exporters as well. Saudi Arabia, South Korea, I know there will probably be more. And basically, it looks like one day we're going to be looking at a saturated global arms market with too many sellers and maybe not enough buyers.
And how does that compare to today's situation? Is it the reverse?
I think at least over the last couple of years, it would be the reverse. It's been there have been definitely enough buyers for predominantly U.S. and Russian arms, and now China is sort of coming online too as a major exporter as well. So you're going to have
this just be a supply and demand issue, where there's significant demand and market entrants are looking to meet that demand.
Yeah, but it'll also be interesting. I mean, like in terms, if all these actually, I think there's going to be, it's like the end result is going to be reduced demand. I think because even if you look at you look at some of the upstarts for potential new sellers on the global market, conventionally speaking, they used to be major buyers. So not only are you creating more potential sellers, but you're removing buyers from the market because they're starting to develop their own domestic platforms.
And what will happen to those extra arms? Will it be dumped on African nations?
Well,
or other
who I no idea. It's I mean, like, it's so hard to know what's coming next. So
and are there any other countries or considerations in terms of international arms development and sale?
I think it's interesting to look at China as an exporter that's coming online. China's generally been a buyer of arms for a long time, and now it's going to sort of, it's reaching a point of maturity in its own internal market that it can start to turn around and provide cheaper, but still quite technically apt, like platforms that, I mean, you know, for example, its drone is, I think it's JQ9 drone is, starkly similar to the Reaper, but, I think it's actually substantial. I don't even think that, you know,
it's a less expensive Chinese.
It's less expensive. And also generally speaking, the Chinese arms exports are, they're not so controlled in terms of who gets them, right? I mean, the United States has these regulations that are increasingly ignored, but or just gotten rid of, about where the technology can end up. Generally speaking, China does not have such regulations. So I mean, like, I think that that's a good example of what I was just talking about, of a buyer turning into a seller. And now, you know, China has very, you know, advanced platforms that it can sell itself.
And does this increased production demonstrate or indicate a increase in arms generally? Are countries increasing their military spending and building their military infrastructure?
I don't have the statistics on me right now, but I would recommend checking out the Stockholm CIPRI, Institute for Peace, statistics. They maintain a pretty good suite of statistics about global arms sales on the year to year. I think we've been peaking the last couple of years. We've been going up. It's definitely been going, I mean, like, yeah, the trend has been going up since, you know, there was a major dip after the Cold War, and now it's basically a U shape. We're going back up. We're on the right side of the U.
And are you familiar with any changes or considerations from the idea that in the future there'll be fewer country-on-country conflicts, it'll be more terrorism and insurgencies and guerrilla warfare tactics? Has that come up at all in your research?
Not majorly that I know of, because I've been focusing more on the industrial side of it. I will say that the EU is starting to budget more for sort of atypical hybrid conflict in its own planning. For example, some of the money that's going into the European Defense Fund is going into fighting disinformation campaigns, for example, and psychological ops.
And that would be a great topic for another episode.
Oh, we're definitely gonna be all over that in the future.
And had some good articles in the past as well that we could bring back up and discuss. Yeah,
for sure.
Okay, wonderful. Zach, is there anything else that you want to add based on your articles and the content posted on the site?
No, just that, you know, keep an eye out for the end of the arms sales series. And we're going to have our global forecasts up towards the end of December, early January. And basically, hope that everyone has a wonderful holidays.
Wonderful. And to our listeners, you can go to geopoliticalmonitor.com to subscribe. And you can also access all of the articles that we've been discussing. And more. So you can check us out at geopoliticalmonitor.com. And until next time, it's Nick Wright and Zachary Fillingham of Geopolitical Monitor. Talk to you later.